and statistics can give us those. We want our information manageable and easy to understand. Statistics can give us that, too. The problem, of course, is that statistics give us the straight facts, except when they don't. Statistics can give us the facts we need in ways that are easy to understand, but they can also give us the facts in ways that are prone to mislead and be manipulated. Let's start with statistics and the facts. The appeal of statistics is that they are so hard-edged and factual. It's great to be able to settle an argument with simple numbers. The influence of environment on language and thought. Eskimos have 200 different words for snow. You think handguns aren't a problem? Then how about that statistic from a minute ago? Every year since 1950, twice as many American children have been killed with guns. Unfortunately, those so-called statistics are factoids rather than facts. They are truthy rather than true. It's not true that the Eskimo have 200 different words for snow, or at least not simply true. The other factoid has taken on a life of its own, but it's not true that every year since 1950, twice as many children have been killed with guns. Information conveyed numerically is just like any other information. It may or may not be true. The unfortunate psychological fact is that people seem to be more inclined to believe a claim simply because it comes with precise numbers. Consider Senator Joe McCarthy and the communist witch hunts of the 1950s. It's because of Senator Joe that we have the term McCarthyism. He loved precise numbers. He loved the hard-edged power they conveyed. In one address, he claimed to have in his hand a list of 205 names, names of people working in the State Department known to be members of the Communist Party. At another point, the list was said to have 207 names. Later it was 57, and at one point, 81. He gave precise numbers every time, numbers that seemed to convey credibility just because they were numbers. But the numbers on the list kept changing. And in fact, there were no such numbers because McCarthy had no such list. The lure of precision. That's why numerical information spreads fast, far, and wide. But the lure of numbers may help it spread whether it's true or not. Often, the numbers get even more impressive and even farther from the truth as the information spreads. That's what happened with the Eskimo words for snow. In 1911, the anthropologist Franz Boas reported that the Inuit use four apparently distinct roots for snow on the ground, falling snow, drifting snow, and a snowdrift. That comment was picked up and used by Edward Sapir and Benjamin Lee Whorf, who wanted to argue that the character of our language determines the character of our thought. In Whorf's article, the number had increased to 7. With repetition, it continued to grow. A 1984 editorial in the New York Times put it at 100. I've often heard it said that the Eskimo have 200 words for snow. When you track it down, the facts are very different. They're actually much more interesting. The Inuit languages are polysynthetic, which means that they form compound nouns in just about any way you want. As the German author Catherine Passig says in one of her short stories, that means that even seldom used expressions like snow that falls on a red t-shirt are combined into one word. Even in English, we have lots of different roots related to snow. Powder, slush, snowflake, blizzard. Somehow, Franz Boas's comment about four snow-related roots in Inuit languages mutated into that widely circulated but misguided claim about 200 distinct words for snow. Something similar happened with the claim that twice as many American children have been killed with guns every year since 1950. Joel Best is a sociologist at the University of Delaware and the author of a great book on misleading statistics. He nominates this as the most inaccurate social statistic ever. Suppose it were true that child deaths due to guns had doubled each year. Start with just one child killed with a gun in 1950. If the number doubles each year, that means there would have been two kids killed in 1951, four in 1952, eight in 1953, doubling each year. By 1960, the number would have been 1,024. It would have passed 1 million dead kids in the year 1970 alone. By 1980, there would have been 1 billion kids killed with guns. That would mean that more kids were killed in the United States in 1980 than there were people living in the United States in 1980. Joel Best first encountered the claim in a dissertation prospectus. But the dissertation cited a source, and he found it in the source, too. There it was, in academic black and white. Every year since 1950, the number of American children gunned down has doubled. And where did that come from? It came from a 1994 report by the Children's Defense Fund. But what they actually said was, quote, since 1950, the number of American children gunned down every year has doubled. Consider those two sentences closely. Do you see the difference? What the original report actually said was that the number of gun-related child deaths doubled between 1950 and 1994. Quote, since 1950, the number of American children gunned down every year has doubled. The U.S. population grew by 72% between 1950 and 1994. It almost doubled. So the change in gun-related child deaths per capita wasn't particularly dramatic. What that statistic mutated into, just by a different placement of the phrase every year, was the outrageous claim that the number of deaths doubled every year. What a difference the placement of that phrase makes. One of the great things about statistics is that they are explicitly factual. That means they can be checked. But checking may be hard, and a bogus number may spread and mutate faster than it's possible to actually check it. Moreover, a bogus number is often dramatic. Front page news. The retraction doesn't make the front page. Mark Twain said that there are three kinds of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics. He attributed that phrase to the British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli. It's interesting that when you track that down, the phrase doesn't actually appear in Disraeli. Statistics represent some kind of counting by someone, somewhere. And counting is about as objective as things get. But in evaluating statistics, you have to pay attention to who did the counting and how. The foundation of all statistics is the sample, the group you count from. In evaluating statistics, it's always important to pay attention to that sample and where it came from. The perennial problem is that the basic sample may turn out to be unrepresentative. I'm sure you've watched the network projections of the winner in a presidential election, moving east to west and state to state. I'm sure you've also noted that the networks try to scoop each other by getting their results out first. The classic case was Al Gore versus George W. Bush in 2000. At 7:48 on election night, first the Associated Press, then CNN, and then all the networks called Florida for Gore. Many commentators started to speak of Gore as the next president. How was that early projection made? Only a small portion of the voting precincts had officially reported. The results at 7:48 were based predominantly on exit polling. How's that done? They pick a certain percentage of precincts to sample, and they ask people leaving the polls whether they'd fill out a 30 to 40 item questionnaire. You don't do it for all precincts, and you don't do it for all voters. There are tens of thousands of voting precincts in the United States. At best, a few thousand are sampled, with perhaps 100 voters per precinct. You can see how that could go wrong. And it did. By 9:30 on election night, with more precincts in, using their own exit polling, the Bush team challenged the network results. By 9:55, all the networks had changed their verdict from Gore wins to too close to call. Here, one issue is sampling size. You want to know something about all voters. The bigger a percentage you actually get results from, the more confident you'll be that the sampling reflects the true reality. Here, the sampling space was small. A more important problem, however, was that the sampling space for the exit surveys might have been unintentionally biased. They didn't sample all precincts in Florida, and Florida is known for being a very heterogeneous state. The choice of which precincts to sample may therefore have slanted the results. Asking for volunteers may itself have slanted the results. What if the Florida voters who had more time to spend answering 40 questions were also those more likely to have voted for Gore? There may also be a feedback loop. What if people thought one candidate was more likely to win because of what they'd heard over the media, perhaps, and were more inclined to fill out a volunteer survey if they had just voted for that candidate? I don't think it applies in this case, but questionnaires often come with their own biases. A major issue is the leading question. If you're like me, you've gotten unsolicited telephone calls that say you've been chosen to participate in a survey. But the questions in the survey may be things like this. Do you agree with most Americans that it's time we got a handle on decay in our inner cities? Do you think it's important to back our troops by giving them the support they need? Think what it would take to answer those questions in the negative. No, I don't agree with most Americans. I think decay in the inner cities is just fine as it is. No, I don't think we should back our troops, even if they need it. Who would really say that? If the statistics we are dealing with are taken from that kind of questionnaire, the data is biased simply by the way the question was asked. And yet, when results are reported, you may have no way of knowing that the original questions were loaded. Okay, it's your turn for some critical statistical analysis. Here, for a typical year, is a graph of the number of drivers in fatal crashes by age group. For 16 to 19-year-olds, there were 6,000 fatal crashes. For 20 to 24-year-olds, the number jumps to almost 9,000. From there, it tapers down by five-year intervals. Those over 79 counted for less than 1,000 fatal crashes. That suggests that people between 20 to 24 are a major hazard on the road. I knew it. But it also suggests that people under 20 to 24 are safer drivers, and that people become progressively safer from that age on. A glance at the chart will tell you that people over 79 are the safest drivers of all. Here's the challenge for you. Is there something wrong with the chart? Is there something wrong with drawing that conclusion from it? Press pause if you want, think about it, and then come back. The data in the chart may be entirely accurate, but the conclusion it's tempting to draw are not. What the chart shows is the absolute number of drivers in certain age categories involved in fatal crashes, but there aren't very many people over 79 who drive, and thus fewer of those to be involved in fatal crashes. The same thing happens at the bottom end of the scale. Because not all 16 to 19-year-olds drive, there are fewer of them on the road than 20 to 24-year-olds. The sampling, then, is uneven. Because of that, the graph doesn't show you what you might think it does. In order to know what age categories are safest, we need the number of fatal crashes relative to the number of people in that category who are actually driving. Even better, we need a number of fatal crashes per miles driven by people in different age categories. When you take that into account, you get a very different graph. It becomes clear that people on the extremes of the age spectrum aren't the safest. They're the ones with the most accidents per mile. They're the ones to look out for. Suppose we've tracked down a statistic, established that it's genuinely factual, and have established that the basic samples are representative. If we have that, we have a pretty solid statistic. But there's still room for misrepresentation. Statistics can package important and complex information in a simple and understandable way. That's one of the great things about statistics. It's also one of the potential pitfalls. In order to condense something to a single number, you inevitably have to leave some information out. That's what makes it tidy. But what information to emphasize and what information to leave out is always a choice. The difference between means and medians is a good example. The mean of a series of numbers is what most people think of as the average. If you want the average SAT score for students from North Dakota, you add up all the scores and divide them by the number of North Dakota students who took the test. Presto, the average, or more technically, the mean. Statistics are often reported in terms of the mean, but that can be misleading. Consider the salaries of 1985 graduates of the University of North Carolina immediately upon graduation by department. Which graduates could boast the highest salaries? Those in computer science, maybe? Business? Actually, the graduates with the highest mean salary were those in cultural geography. The figure in most departments was below 40 or 50,000, but the mean salary for graduates in cultural geography was in the hundreds of thousands. Cultural geography? How come those guys are making so much? The fact is that there were very few people who graduated in cultural geography from the University of North Carolina in 1985. But one of them was the basketball star Michael Jordan. He was making enough already, but 1985 was also the year that Nike introduced their Air Jordan line. A major problem with using average or mean as a measure is that it's vulnerable to the problem of outliers. One enormous salary in a bunch can lift the mean in extremely misleading ways. There are really three concepts to consider. If we're talking salaries, the mean is the average salary. The mode is the typical salary, what most people got. The median is something like the middle salary, the salary such that about half got more than that and half got less. Let's look at all of those in a simple example. There are just 9 people in the company. 4 of them work on the shop floor, each earning $20,000 a year. There's one shop foreman who makes $30,000. There are 2 managers and a salesman, each of whom make $40,000 each. The boss gives himself a salary of $200,000. What's the average salary in that company? Add up 4 times $20,000, plus $30,000, plus 3 times $40,000, plus $200,000, divide by 9. That's the mean salary. It comes out a little shy of $48,000. But that's not the typical salary. In this case, the mode, the category with the most people in it, is just $20,000. The mean salary of $48,000 is more than anybody in the company gets, except the boss, just like the Michael Jordan case. In this case, the median is $30,000, the shop foreman's salary. There are 4 people getting less than that. There are 4 people getting more. That's the median. So the mode is $20,000, the mean is almost $48,000, the median is $30,000. Means, modes, and medians all give you simple numbers, but they may give you different numbers. Which you choose is always that, a choice. It's to be expected that people on different sides of an issue pushing a different line will make a different choice. In the debate over a federal tax cut, Proponents of the bill claimed that the average family tax reduction would be more than $1,000. That makes it sound like a great deal for the taxpayer. Opponents claimed that more than half of all families wouldn't see a tax cut that hit even $100. That doesn't make it sound like such a great deal. In fact, both statistics were solid, factual, and well sampled. It's just that one result was reported in terms of the mean, while the other was reported in the spirit of the median. The truth is that all of those measures lose information. Anything that compresses a complex social reality into a single number is going to lose information. If you want more, you want to see how the numbers distribute across your sample. That demands something more like a graph. But here again, there are possibilities for misrepresentation. There are two problems that happen with statistical graphs. Consider two graphs that claim to show the changes in violent crime between 1993 and 2010. Look at the difference in these graphs. One shows a very slight decrease over time. One shows a dramatic decline. Which one's right? They're both right. They portray precisely the same data. The difference is just in how they portray it. The choice of scale on a graph can exaggerate or minimize the effect. If crimes fell from 120,000 to 100,000, and we put that on a graph that shows just the range from 100,000 to 120,000, the decline is going to look huge. It'll fill the entire graph. If we put that same information on a graph that ranges from 0 to 1 million, the decline's going to look almost unnoticeably tiny. In trying to represent data with statistics, you have to choose which statistics to use. In trying to represent data with graphics, you have to choose which graphics to use. Today, anyone with a spreadsheet program can experiment with different graphics for their data. That makes it very easy for someone to shop around for that form of graph that seems to make their point most dramatically. That may not be such a great thing for the consumer of statistics. And we're all consumers. Sometimes statistics concern not just one thing, but a relationship between two. Consider the graph I described at the beginning of the lecture. For the period between 1960 and 1970, one line shows the number of people executed for murder in the United States each year. The other line shows the homicide rate. The dramatic thing is that those lines go in directly the opposite directions. It's precisely as the execution rate falls that the homicide rate increases. In one of the earliest sophisticated statistical studies of deterrence, Isaac Ehrlich used data from executions and the homicide rate from 1933 to 1969, including this data. Do homicide rates go up when execution rates go down? Ehrlich's answer was yes. He phrased his conclusion this way: an additional execution per year may have resulted in 7 or 8 fewer murders. That sounds pretty impressive. That statistic was quickly put to work by the Attorney General in a case before the Supreme Court. But this is where an important distinction comes in. What the graph shows is correlation. It's a fact. Between 1960 and 1970, murder rates go up and execution rates go down. Ehrlich's conclusion, on the other hand, is phrased in terms of causes. An additional execution per year may have resulted in 7 or 8 fewer murders. That claim is not just murder rates go up and execution rates go down. That claim is murder rates go up because execution rates go down. Correlation and cause are not the same. What you get from statistics like that is, at best, correlation. That's important in judging causality, but correlation alone never just gives you causal information. Remember post hoc ergo propter hoc. A and B might be correlated because A causes B, or because B causes A, or because some third element C causes both of them. Here's a correlation, for example. Lung cancer rates are correlated with the number of ashtrays in someone's house. But that's not because ashtrays cause cancer. It's because smoking causes both lung cancer and the accumulation of ashtrays. And sometimes correlation is just coincidence. So what is it in this case? Ehrlich's was a sophisticated statistical study and was subjected to sophisticated statistical critique. The central issue, however, has to do with information that doesn't appear on the graph. If you look at all crime between 1960 and 1970, you'll see that all crime rose on the same curve that murders did. Burglaries, robberies, car thefts all went up in the 60s and went up in the same way, but none of those other crimes carried the death penalty. So perhaps murders were on the rise for some other reason, or some host of reasons, the reasons that were driving all crime up. Perhaps other factors were in play. Perhaps the correlation between declining executions and increasing murders isn't enough to show a cause. Ehrlich's study spans the period between 1933 and 1970. It's on that data that he concludes that the death penalty does deter murder. But it's that 10-year period between 1960 and 1970 that turns out to be crucial. The same study done on just the period from 1933 to 1960 showed no deterrent effect at all. Don't get me wrong. I'm arguing neither for nor against a deterrent effect. I think the question is complicated. What I am saying is that dramatic graphs that correlate a rise in murders with a decline in executions suggest a short and immediate proof of causality that doesn't really exist. Lots of factors may be at play, including factors that don't show up in the graph. A single correlation like this won't tell us what we really want to know about cause. Sometimes we have statistical information on correlation, but just don't know about cause. Here's a statistic for you. Among college graduates, it turns out that left-handers earn more than right-handers. Among the general population, there's no difference. That's strange. I wonder what it means. Here are some other intriguing numbers. Of 7 recent U.S. presidents, 4 have been left-handed, while a 5th was said to have been ambidextrous. Gerald Ford was left-handed, and Ronald Reagan was left-handed at birth. Reagan's VP, left-handed George H.W. Bush, later became president too. Left-handed Bill Clinton won against him in a 3-way race that also included left-hander Ross Perot. More recently, it was the left-handed Barack Obama who defeated the left-handed John McCain. Those statistics offer a surprising correlation between left-handedness and success, or at least ambition. Is there some causal connection? The answer is, we simply don't know. You can spin some plausible causal stories, but the correlations, even if real, don't tell you those causal stories are true. Here then is the take-home message on statistics and spin. Statistics are great. They give us factual information in an easily understandable way, except when they don't. Beware of Joe McCarthy and the lure of precise numbers. Statistics are great because they can be checked, and they should be. Who did the counting, and how? The sample is the first place to look. Is that sample representative? If we're dealing with a questionnaire, was there bias built into the questions asked? Statistical representation always represents a choice. Why did they use mean rather than some other statistic? Why did they use that graph, scaled in that way? And finally, remember that correlation isn't cause. In the next lecture, we'll use the kinds of techniques we developed here to look at poker, probability, and everyday life. We gamble all the time. It may not be called gambling. We reserve that term for high-risk games in casinos. But we're always playing the odds. We play the odds as individuals when we decide to drive a few hundred miles to have Thanksgiving with family or friends, despite the fact that we might have an accident on the highway. We play the odds as individuals when we decide what job to take, or where to live, or whether to marry a particular person. In none of these cases is the outcome a matter of certainty. We know lots of things can happen. We try to figure out what's most likely to happen and make our choices accordingly. Life is chancy, but we try to deal with chance rationally. As a culture, we gamble all the time, too. Science stands as one of the greatest intellectual achievements of all time. But outside of mathematics, none of our scientific conclusions is a certainty. We use what we call scientific laws to calculate trajectories to the moon, safety margins in factories, procedures for public vaccination against disease. But our confidence in those predictions is all based on a batch of evidence, we hope good enough, and a best guess on the basis of that evidence. Our culture, and perhaps any culture, is based on that kind of gambling. So the question isn't whether to gamble or not. As long as we live and breathe, we're forced to play the odds. The question is whether we'll gamble rationally or not. That's what this lecture is all about. The problem is that we often don't gamble rationally. Probability is another name for what we're talking about. The problem is that we often don't handle probabilities rationally. Which is more dangerous, a handgun or a swimming pool? Your 8-year-old has two friends living 2 houses away on each side of you. You know that one family has a swimming pool. You know that the other family keeps a gun in the house. Which is the safer place for her to play? If we take the statistics seriously, swimming pools are far more dangerous. About 550 children drown in swimming pools each year. That's about one per every 11,000 residential swimming pools. About 175 children are killed by guns each year. That's about one for every 1 million guns in the United States. Both statistics are horrible, but the probability of a child drowning in a swimming pool is over 3 times greater than the probability of a child being killed with a gun. Why do we tend to think otherwise? Imagine kids playing in a swimming pool. That's a wonderfully positive image. The image of kids with guns, on the other hand, is frightening. When it comes to probabilities, we tend to think in terms of images instead. It's those images that often lead us astray. Here's another question for you. In terms of annual deaths, which of these is the most dangerous? Asthma? Drowning? Tornadoes? Fireworks? What do you think? Asthma is the big killer, accounting for about 4,000 deaths a year. Drowning's up there too, claiming about 3,500 lives. Tornadoes, we had a particularly bad year recently. In a typical year, the rate is less than 100 people. Fireworks, 3 or 4 deaths each year. Death by tornado is a vivid image, as is death from fireworks. Both are the kind of thing that shows up on the news. Asthma isn't. Yet people are about 1,000 times more likely to die from asthma than from fireworks. The relative vividness of the images makes us miscalculate probabilities. Vividness of images and what shows up on the news may also be what reinforces buying lottery tickets. The happy grand prize winner for the multi-state lottery might be a news item for about 30 seconds. If we compiled a news show of 1-second pictures of every person who bought a ticket but didn't win the grand prize, we'd be watching that show for over 6 years. Let's talk about how to be more rational about probabilities. The probabilities we're really concerned with are the important probabilities we have to calculate as individuals and as a society. Probabilities of economic downturns, of natural disasters, of the impact of airbags and seatbelts on child fatalities, for example. But here as elsewhere, it helps to start with the simple cases. Here's the simplest case of all. I've got a quarter in my hand. What's the chance that it'll come up heads? That's right, 50-50. a 50% chance of heads, probability 1 over 2. That's the simplest case. It's a perfect instance of the general rule. In all calculations like this, we want to know how many ways can it come up? 2, leaving out edges. How many of those count as heads? The probability of heads is the ratio of the number of possible outcomes in your chosen category, heads, over the total number of possible outcomes. That's the central concept of probability. All probability is a calculation of that ratio. Everything else we'll talk about is merely a shortcut for calculating that fundamental concept. Remember that you can always come back to that. When we're talking about probability, we're talking about the number of possible outcomes in a chosen category over the total number of possible outcomes. So take another simple case. You have a complete shuffled deck of 52 cards. Let me give you some questions. Listen to them, press pause, and then figure out the answers. You draw a card at random. What's the chance that it's the Ace of Spades? What's the chance that it's a red card? What's the chance that it's a face card, a Jack, Queen, or King? What's the chance that it's a red face card? In each case, we're applying the basic concept of probability. How many different ways can a single draw come out? As many ways as there are cards in the deck. If we don't have any jokers, that's 52. In calculating each of these probabilities, we're just counting how many of those 52 possible draws count as in our category. How many of the 52 possible draws are in the category Ace of Spades? Just one. The odds are 1 in 52. How many of the 52 are in the category a red card? Half the cards are red, 26 over 52. How many count as face cards? There are 3 face cards in each suit. 3 clubs, 3 hearts, 3 diamonds, and 3 spades are face cards. That makes 12. The odds? 12 and 52. And what's the probability of a red face card? Half of that, 6 and 52. Yes, I could have reduced the fractions, but there's no need to. What we're interested in is the ratio, and that remains the same. The number of possible outcomes in a chosen category over the total number of possible outcomes. That's the core concept of probability. But there's an important proviso. In order for that to work, we have to be talking about equiprobable outcomes. In the questions I just asked you, I specified a well-shuffled deck. Suppose I had done this instead. Suppose I had taken a brand new deck, opened it up, and shuffled it. Suppose I had then asked you something like, I draw a card. What are the chances that it's the Ace of Spades? If I pull the card out from the upper half of a face-down deck, like I just did, I can tell you exactly what the chances are of drawing the Ace of Spades. 0. Why? Every new deck has the Ace of Spades as the first card you see, the bottom card of a face-down deck. If you cut and do a riffle shuffle, alternating cards like I just did, all of the spades are still going to be on the bottom half of the deck. The ace is going to be on the bottom of the spades. It turns out that 6 or 7 riffle shuffles can be a pretty good randomizer. It turns out that less than 5 shuffles aren't very good. True randomization demands that all possibilities be equiprobable. It's been shown that with just 5 shuffles, it's absolutely impossible to get all the cards in the reverse order. With just 5 shuffles, then, all the orders aren't equiprobable. The basic principle of probability demands equiprobable outcomes. Given that, we can always calculate probability as the number of outcomes in our chosen category over the total number of outcomes. That works great for standard games of chance. Cards and dice and roulette wheels are made for easily calculated equal probable outcomes. But we also want to use probability in real life. And real life isn't made that way. What's the probability that a hurricane will hit New York next year? Or New Orleans? What's the probability of a tornado taking out Omaha? Or Sacramento? In real life cases like that, we don't count up possible outcomes. How many equal probable outcomes are there anyway? You can't count possible hurricane tracks the way you can count face cards. Nonetheless, we do often calculate probabilities in something like the same way. Let me illustrate with coin flips. We know that the probability of a quarter coming up heads is 1/2. If you flip a coin 20 times, how many heads will you expect to get? If you said about 10, well, you're about right. You shouldn't expect to get exactly 10 heads. The perfect cut of half and half is pretty unlikely with small numbers. But here's the fundamental fact. As the number of flips gets larger, the probabilities rise that the result will be increasingly close to a 50-50 split. This is known as the law of large numbers. In the long run, frequencies of heads and tails will tend to even out. And how long is the long run? It doesn't have an exact number, 100,000 or 1 million or 100 million flips. What it really means is the longer the better. The longer the run, the better the bet that frequencies will be close to our calculated probabilities. John Maynard Keynes was one of the great economists of the early 20th century. As Keynes noted, that long run can be a misleading guide to current affairs. In the long run, he said, we're all dead. Here's why the law of large numbers does matter, even in current affairs and in real life. It links probability with frequencies. If the probability of heads is 1/2, then in the long run, we can expect about half the flips to come up heads. In other words, if the probability is 1/2, long-range frequency will approach 1/2. In real life, we estimate probabilities by reasoning in the other direction, from frequencies to estimated probabilities. If we see a die come up 6s with a frequency of 90 times in 100 throws, we figure it's a loaded die. Reasoning from the observed frequencies to an estimated probability, we figure that the probability of a 6 on the next throw will be about 90%. We do the same thing with natural events. What's the probability of a hurricane hitting New Orleans this year? There are several ways of doing that, and of course it depends on what you count as a hit. But here's a simple way. By one reckoning, New Orleans has been hit by hurricanes 61 times in the last 139 years. That's a frequency of 61 over 139, or about 43 out of 100. Reading our probability off that frequency, we'd say the probability of a hurricane hitting New Orleans this year is about 40%. Probability is the insurance company's business. They use all of the sophisticated statistics they can find. At base, however, their calculations are grounded in precisely this kind of calculation, an attempt to estimate probabilities on the basis of frequency data. If we want to deal with the real probabilities, we have to pay attention to real frequencies. Images aren't enough. A shark attack is a vivid image. That's what Jaws is all about. You can practically hear the music, can't you? But in order to live rationally in a chancy world, we have to do more than think in images. Otherwise, we'll be scared of the wrong things and scared when we don't need to be. We have to look at the real frequencies, at the real statistics. Those tell us that we should worry a lot less about having sharks around and a lot more about having lifeguards. Cards and dice are neat and tidy. We project our probability calculations to estimate frequencies in the long run. Tornadoes and hurricanes aren't nearly so tidy. There we think backwards from observed frequencies to estimates of background probabilities. Once we have probability estimates for basic events of either type, however, the rules for calculating combined probabilities are the same. We often want to know not just the probability of hydraulic system failure in a plane, not just the probability of landing gear problems, not just the probability of pilot error, but the probability of any of those things going wrong. For that kind of case, we need to be able to calculate combined probabilities. We'll start simple. Suppose we're playing stud poker. I have to stick with the five cards I'm dealt. If we know the probability that I'll be dealt a straight of some kind, and we know the probability that I'll be dealt two pairs, can we calculate the probability that I'll be dealt one or the other? Sure, it's easy. We just add those probabilities together. A straight, the probability is less than 1%. In fact, it's a little over 0.39%. The probability of being dealt two pairs is significantly better, just shy of 5%. So the probability of getting one or the other, add those two probabilities. A straight or two pairs, the probability is just shy of 5.39%. By the way, the probability of getting nothing in stud poker, just the value of your highest card, about 50%. Half the hands dealt will be nothing more. That same simple rule works for some of the probabilities we estimate empirically. If we know the probability of a tornado hitting Omaha and not Sioux Falls, and if we know the probability of a tornado hitting Sioux Falls and not Omaha, can we calculate the probability of a tornado hitting one or the other but not both? Yes, we just add them. If the probability of a tornado hitting Omaha and not Sioux Falls is 1%, and the probability of a tornado hitting Sioux Falls and not Omaha is 1%, the probability of a tornado hitting Omaha or Sioux Falls but not both is 2%. You may be able to tell from my careful phrasing that there's an important proviso on the simple addition rule. Adding probabilities this way works only if the two events are mutually exclusive, only if we know they can't both happen. If you deal me just five cards, those cards can't be both two pairs and a straight. If it's a straight, no two cards are alike. If I have two pairs, that can't be a straight. Those outcomes are mutually exclusive. It's when the two outcomes are mutually exclusive that we can find the probability of one or the other just by adding the probabilities. If a tornado hits Omaha and not Sioux Falls, that tornado can't also hit Sioux Falls and not Omaha. Those are mutually exclusive. In that case, we can just add the probabilities. That's the simple rule for or. There's an equally simple rule for and. If we know the probability of drawing a red card from deck number one, and we know the probability of drawing a black card from deck number two, can we calculate the probability of doing both? What's the probability of drawing red from deck one and black from deck two? In that case, we just multiply. The probability of drawing a red card from deck one, 1/2. The probability of drawing a black from deck two, 1/2. The probability of doing both, 1/2 times 1/2, 1/4. We can do it for real probabilities too. If we know the probability of a tornado hitting Sacramento and a hurricane hitting Atlanta in a given year, can we calculate the probability of both happening, a tornado in Sacramento and a hurricane in Atlanta? Sure, we just multiply them. A tornado in Sacramento, let's say 1%. A hurricane in Atlanta, let's say 2%. What's the probability of both happening? 0.01 times 0.02, 1% of 2%. A mere 0.02%. The simple rule for and comes with a proviso just like the simple rule for or did. You can figure the probabilities for two things happening by multiplying their individual probabilities as long as they are independent events. Whoa, let's take a break. Where did all this probability theory come from anyway? It came from gambling. You probably know that's where the sandwich came from. From John Montagu, the fourth Earl of Sandwich, known as an avid gambler. Late one night in 1762, the legend goes, Montague was too busy gambling even to stop to eat. Just bring me my beef between two pieces of bread, he shouted. And thus the sandwich was born. Probability theory came from the ponderings of a French nobleman a century earlier, the avid gambler Antoine Gambault, Chevalier de Mireille. The Chevalier was trying to figure out what he should bet on, a double six coming up in 24 throws of the dice. So he did what any well-heeled aristocrat might do. He wrote to two of the best mathematicians in the world. He wrote to Blaise Pascal, who we'll talk about in the next lecture, and Pierre de Fermat. That got the mathematicians talking about rational betting odds. As they say, the rest is history. Okay, back to work. We just introduced the concept of independent events. You can figure the probabilities for two things happening by multiplying their individual probabilities as long as they are independent events. What does it mean to say that two events are independent? They are probabilistically isolated. No strings of influence between them. The fact that one happens doesn't affect whether the other will. Successive flips of a coin are independent. If I flip a coin once, the chance of heads is 1/2. If I flip it a second time, the chance of heads is again 1/2. What comes out on the second flip doesn't depend on what came out on the first flip. They're independent events. The quarter doesn't remember what it did last time. As far as it knows, every flip is a new day, a clean slate. That's what it means to say that coin flips are independent events. So are rolls of the dice. So are spins of a roulette wheel. Card games are often a mixture. Take traditional blackjack, in which the dealer plays several rounds before shuffling the deck. Because the hands played last round don't go back into the deck, you know that those cards won't appear on this round. The probabilities this time around are not entirely independent of the last round. That observation is at the core of card counting schemes, in which players keep count of high cards on the one hand, aces and tens, and low cards on the other, adjusting their play accordingly. If someone is going to gamble rationally, it's important that they know whether what they're betting on are independent events or not. But we know that people often don't bet rationally. One way they don't is called the gambler's fallacy. You commit the gambler's fallacy if you treat events that are independent as if they aren't. Mr. and Mrs. Smith have 5 children, all boys. They sure would like a girl. And they say, oh, don't worry, with 5 boys in a row, the next one's bound to be a girl. Well, of course it's not bound to be a girl. Your reproductive system doesn't have a memory any more than the coin does. The sex of your next child is an independent event. Sometimes people offer a little more reasoning. With 5 boys in a row, the next one's bound to be a girl. What are the chances you'd get 6 boys in a row? Tiny, right? Well, the chances of 6 boys in a row are tiny. After all, if odds are 50-50, the chance of 6 boys is 1/2 times 1/2 times 1/2 times 1/2 times 1. The chance of having 6 boys is 1 in 64. But that's not the question. The question is, given that you already have 5 boys, what are the chances that the next child will be a boy? And the chances of that are precisely the same as the chance that the first one was going to be a boy. Each birth is an independent event. Mr. and Mrs. Smith have committed the gambler's fallacy, treating independent events as if they aren't independent. Some people have even worked the fallacy into what they think is a system. If the roulette wheel comes up with a string of reds, they'll bet black. Because it's got to come up black now. There are, of course, other ways that irrationality creeps into gambling. It's been shown that sleep deprivation increases the chance of making a risky gamble. Perhaps that's why many casinos are open 24 hours a day. In this lecture, we've looked at a few simple rules that are special cases of the full laws of probability. Using those more complicated laws, it's possible to calculate combined probabilities even when events are not mutually exclusive or not independent. I'm afraid we don't have time to go into that here. Here's an example, however. You may already know this one. You find yourself with 30 or 40 other people in a restaurant, office, or gym. What are the chances that two of those people were born on the same day of the year? In fact, it's very probable you'd have two people born on the same day of the year. The calculation might go like this. We pick a person number one to start with. Of course, there was a particular day that they were born on, October 15th, maybe. We then pick a person number two. The probability that they were born on a different day, pretty likely. There are 364 days that aren't October 15th. So the odds that person two had a different birthday from person one are 364 out of 365. Take person number three. What are the odds that they have a different birthday from the first two? We've eliminated 2 days, person number one's birthday and person number two's birthday. The chances of number three having a different birthday are now down to 363 out of 365. As we add people, we keep multiplying by those probabilities of having a different birthday than the previous ones. So it's 364 out of 365 times 363 out of 365 times 362 over 365 times 361 over 365 times. You can prove it for yourself, but at just 23 people, that multiplication boils down to just 50-50 odds that those people all have different birthdays. That means 50-50 odds that two of them do have the same birthday. In a room with only 23 people, a small classroom, the odds are 50-50 that two people share the same birthday. At 30 people, the probability reaches 70% that two birthdays match. At 35, it becomes an 80% probability that two people are alike. With 50 people, the probability of a match hits 97%. Next time you're at a party with 35 people, you should feel free to bet that two have the same birthday. Have them announce birthdays in turn, and have anyone else shout out if they have the same birthday. Life is chancy. With any fewer than 365 people, it's not absolutely guaranteed, but 80% is a pretty safe bet. That's rational gambling. I wish I had room for another lecture on probability. What I've given you are just a few simple principles, but they'll have to do for now. I hope you'll remember the simple principles of probability. There are really only three of them. The basic concept. In probability, we're always talking about the number of possible outcomes in a chosen category over the total number of possible outcomes. You can always come back to that. The simple rule for the probability of X or Y happening, if they're mutually exclusive, if they can't both happen, the probability of one or the other happening is just the probability of one plus the probability of the other. Addition. The simple rule for the probability of both X and Y happening, if they're independent, the probability of them both happening is just the probability of one times the probability of the other. Multiplication. Finally, and above all, beware the gambler's fallacy. Life is full of decisions, and rational decision-making demands knowing the odds. But good decisions also demand a lot more than that. Next time, we'll explore some of the lessons and some of the limits of decision theory. This lecture focuses on rational decision-making. In the second lecture of the course, we talked about decision-making in emotional contexts. But decision-making is hard enough even without that. It's easy to hit analysis paralysis, in which we defer or even abandon making a decision because it's just too difficult. Sometimes there are just too many options, like in the cereal aisle of the supermarket. Choice is a good thing, but more options may not necessarily make us happier. We hit analysis paralysis. We obsess over a perfect or optimal solution when we should satisfice instead. Sometimes good enough is good enough. You can probably guess how I feel about breakfast cereal. When more important decisions are at stake, ignorance is a major problem. We just don't know what's going to happen if we take this course of action. We don't know what's going to happen if we take that one. Are we making things better or just making them worse? If the context didn't start out emotional, it may end up that way. Decision-making under uncertainty is inherently stressful.